Okay, so the title of today's class was something to the effect about Chad Gadya from the Vilna Gaon. And I also told you that being that it's Rabbi Soloveitchik's Yahrzeit, I wanted to speak about that as well. So somehow we're going to try to combine these two topics. And the way that we're going to do it is as follows. The Vilna Gaon has a commentary on the Chad Gadya. The main thing that we need to keep in mind is that within the Chad Gadya we have events which take place. You'll have time to ask, but I'm not going to answer. Okay, fine. I'll try to leave time for both. I would have known I had to answer questions. I would have prepared more. So the main thing about the Chad Gadya is what I would call certain events take place and then unforeseen consequences. Okay, those are two words. Unforeseen consequences. That's all that we need to keep in mind. Certain historical events happen, something takes place, and then something unforeseen happens afterwards. The Vilna Gaon sees within the Chad Gadya, he sees many things within Jewish history. What we're going to do is we're going to look at his commentary, which will then lead us through, well, I don't want to ruin it for you. Okay, I'm not going to tell you where it leads us, but then we're going to go further. Point number one. First of all, those of us who don't know who the Vilna Gaon was. The Vilna Gaon was known as the genius from Vilna. That doesn't mean all that much. You look at the biography of almost any great rabbi at almost any place in history, and they'll tell you that he was the genius from this place. If you were to follow what we could sometimes make fun of in terms of the art scroll prototype of writing a biography, his father was a Talmud Chacham, his mother was a Tzadekis, and from a very young age, he showed his genius. He had a little difficulty, came past the difficulty, and then became world-renowned. So that's basically the biography, and that's the template. And you can then just fill in the names and the place, and you'll have your standard biography. The Vilna Gaon, it's a little difficult to separate between fact and fiction. The Vilna Gaon in his own lifetime was legendary. If I'll just take a little historical fact, when they had the famous Emden Eifschitz controversy, the Vilna Gaon was approached to adjudicate between the two sides. He was 27 years old at the time. That should tell you something. And by the way, he was wise enough to step aside, which also shows you that he did not fall into he did not fall into the trap of just because he was asked to have to answer, and he was very diplomatic about it. But again, the amazing thing, he was 27 years old at the time, which means at the age of 27, he was already seen as being one of, if not the most important rabbi in Europe. He wasn't the most important posek. The Nodeb Yehuda was probably the most important posek at the time. But the Vilna Gaon was known as a genius. The Vilna Gaon never held a job. I'm sorry to put it in that way. He was never the rabbi of Vilna. He was never the head of the Beis Din, and he never had a yeshiva. The Vilna Gaon sat and learned in Vilna. He was supported, actually, by a fund that was put together by one of his ancestors, who had dedicated money to be set aside if any of his descendants will spend full-time learning. That's how the Vilna Gaon was supported. Some of that money, by the way, was stolen by the person who handled the estate. Things never change. And the Vilna Gaon sat and learned. That's what he did. Again, does it make a difference to you if you really knew all of Tanakh by the time of 3 or 5 or 7? Let me just put it this way. What seems to be impressive about him is, aside from his Torah knowledge, which seems to be the totality of Judaism. When I say the totality is, you can have some people who can miss a source here and there. He never misses a source. It's every verse, and it's every Mishnah, and it's every Gemara, and it's every Rishon. The Vilna Gaon seemed to have total knowledge of rabbinic literature. But his knowledge of rabbinic literature is not like our knowledge. And I'm going to say it like this. He knew the Gemara probably better than we know Ashrei. Right? If I say the word Poseach Es Yadecha, you all know what's next? What's the word before Poseach? The word before Poseach? Right, but you had to go backwards to get it. Yeah. He knew Gemara better than you knew Ashrei. And he was a mathematical genius. And he also immediately knew the value of each word, each phrase, each verse. He valued gematria, mathematics. He was a mathematical genius. He saw things, therefore, on many, many different levels. He also happened to be a world-class scholar in Kabbalistic literature, which is a part of the Vilna Gaon that sometimes we don't necessarily hear about. I was at a conference a couple of years ago in Bar-Ilan University, and one of the lecturers who was speaking about this said, the Vilna Gaon single-handedly wrote more Kabbalistic texts than all of the Hasidic masters combined. Okay, just to begin to imagine what his literary output was, and what's quite amazing is that he barely wrote. Now you say, like, so what's going on? Apparently he never wrote after the age of 40. He himself tells his student Rav Chaim Volozhin, according to Rav Chaim Volozhin, so I'm going to just say, if you can't trust Rav Chaim Volozhin, I don't know who you can trust. He said that he had once, I'll explain a little bit of the background, that there's a rumor that if you understand the Sefer Yetzirah well enough, you can make a golem. Okay? There's a rumor of making a golem. But there's also a rumor that there are deliberate mistakes in the Sefer Yetzirah. So a couple of times, Rav Chaim Volozhin approached the Vilna Gaon and asked him regarding the text of the Sefer Yetzirah, and every time he told him what the correct text was. So he finally said, I wouldn't be surprised if you'd be able to make a golem, and he essentially answers, been there, done that. or he says like this, he says, I once started to do it, and then I got a sign from heaven that I should stop, and I understood it was most likely because how old I was. He says, how old were you? He said, before Bar Mitzvah. The Vilna Gaon had mastered all the writings of the Arizal before the age of Bar Mitzvah. So I'll say it again. He mastered all rabbinic writing at a very young age. He had the kind of mind that I think it's really difficult for us to understand. So when you say he was a genius in every single discipline except for one that his father would not let him study, and that was pharmacology. Because he said, if you know pharmacology, then you're going to have to work. Because then there'll be cases of pikuach nefesh. You're able to save people's lives. People will come. You have to open me like the Rambam was a doctor. If you know pharmacology, then you're going to have to say, you know. So he said, his father said, study all wisdom, everything there is, but pharmacology leave on the side, so you won't know this. As I said, it's very hard to know fact from fiction. I've read books who've limited themselves to only first-hand information from people that knew him. And as far as I can tell, everything I just now told you was based on first-hand information, and not students of students of students, but people who actually knew him. Okay? Now, the Vilna Gaon offers us an interpretation and explanation of the Chad Gadya. He sets down some principles and introductions, and we're going to go through it now. And then, as I said, then we're going to see how to make applications of some of this. Number one. Okay, I have this numbered for you. No one's taking notes, I assume because it's Chol HaMoed. and like my students, you sort of suspect there's no exam at the end, so therefore you don't have to take notes. Number one. All good in this world and the next world, for the Jewish people, emanates from the blessing that Yaakov took from Yitzchak that was destined for Esav. Taking that bracha, we got an unbelievable amount of good. Number one. Number two, when Yaakov goes in to see Yitzchak, where he thinks that it's Esav, he brings with him two G'day Izim, two goats, and according to Chazal, one represents the Korban Chagiga, and one represents the Korban Pesach. Which means, on a certain sense, when he's going in at that point, he is, and let's understand, the Korban Chagiga is really physical, it's to celebrate the holiday, while the Korban Pesach is much more spiritual. The Korban Chagiga was the main meal. The Korban Pesach was eaten after one was already sated. At the end of the meal, al hasova. So therefore, one is physical, one is spiritual. And by the way, pay attention. Yaakov did end up getting from Yitzchak two different brachot. One was physical and one was spiritual. So over here, he brings in the two goats. One will one day, in our language, morph into the korban chagiga, one into the korban pesach. Which means that what he's saying over here is that you're looking at Yaakov going in, you don't really understand what's happening. But by the way, should I explain this in a little bit of a deeper way? When Yaakov takes from Esav the right of being the firstborn, right? There are two things Yaakov takes from Esav, the bracha and the bechorah. When he takes the right of being the firstborn, what did he really take from him? He took from him the inheritance from Avraham. What's the inheritance from Avraham? The Brit Ben Abitarim. What's the Brit Ben Abitarim? That your descendants will be enslaved for 400 years. Well, that sounds like a good deal. But afterwards, what do you get? You get Eretz Yisrael. Okay, the Torah, you get Eretz Yisrael. Which means Yaakov goes in order to, Yaakov takes from Esav the Bechor, the responsibility. He takes from him the Egyptian exile. So if he's taking the Egyptian exile, what else does he need to take when he goes in? He needs also to have the Korban Pesach. Because what's the Korban Pesach? The way that they're going to end up leaving Egypt. So I'm saying that is the deeper level of what that Gemara is teaching us. The Vilna Gaon then says further, but if you understand the deeper level of this, because there's always going to be a deeper level, he says not only is this representative of the Korban Pesach and the Korban Chagiga, it also represents another two goats. But by the way, those of you who don't remember, we're talking about the Chad Gadya. What's Chad Gadya? One little goat. So the one little goat just became two goats, and the two goats just now became four goats. So this is, I don't know, maybe it's a theory of conservation of goats, but this one goat just now keeps on multiplying. So he says, but those are really the same two goats as the Sir La Hashem and the Sir La Zazel from Yom Kippur, because if you really, again, understand it, again, the whole thing is bookmarked with Yaakov and Esav. When Yaakov meets up with Esav all those years later, he gives him off gifts, he bribes him, he gives him something. Those gifts that he gives him becomes the prototype of the Sir La Azazel. So later on, the same way that we bribe Esav, who wants to attack us for having taken the bracha, every year in Yom Kippur, we pay off the Satan, who is in cahoots with Esav, and therefore we end up getting forgiven. Again, one to bring about kapara, that's the Sir La Hashem, and one for pius, to bribe, to calm down the other side, whatever that means. And those who are interested, in Al HaTshuva, the Rav has a very, very interesting essay where he explains exactly how this Seir La'azazel works and what the dynamics are. Point number four. You're keeping count? Point number four. All of the blessings and all of the spiritual good. What do we start with? That all the good that we have came from when Yaakov went in and took it from Yitzchak. Because again, there was a risk that everything could have gone to Esav, but in the end Rivka decides, no, it has to go to Yaakov. Yaakov gets it, that's why we have it. But all the good that Yaakov receives, what does he do with it all? According to the Vilna Gaon on the next stage, in terms of his commentary, he says all of it ends up going to Yosef. And I'll explain to you where this is coming from. If you notice the blessings, remember in Parshat Vayechi, it's the brachos that Yaakov gives to his children? Yes? Parshat Vayechi has all the brachot? No. No. Bracha is only mentioned by one son. Take a look at the text. The only son where it says, I'm giving you a bracha, is when he gives it to Yosef. Yosef is the only one who receives it. Not only does Yosef receive the bracha, what else does Yosef receive? The bechorah, because he's given a double portion. So, if I go back one generation, Yaakov took the bechorah, Yaakov took the bracha, and what does Yaakov do with this? He gives it to Yosef, and now I need to tell you a secret, another secret, and this is going to be parenthetical, and that is, this is point number five, for the Vilna Gaon, again known as the Gra, Hagaon Rebbe Eliyahu, for the Vilna Gaon, the most important character in Tanakh is Yosef. Each one of you can choose your own favorite. the Vilna Gaon, as far as he was concerned, the most important character in Tanakh is Yosef. And that, as I said, you need to keep in mind as well. And therefore, as he's explaining the Chad Gadya, he's explaining the Chad Gadya is not what you think. The Chad Gadya has to do with this one very important goat, which actually is connected to the Korban Pesach, which is actually connected to when Yaakov goes in. Why? Because he needs the Korban Pesach, because he already took the Bechorah. He's already going to go down to Egypt. You need to get out of Egypt. And therefore, all again, I'm going to say it again. Unforeseen consequences that will be taking place. Point number six, as far as the Gruz understanding of, and this is a fancy word, I'm not even making this one up, of eschatology, understanding the end of days, as far as the Vilna Gaon is concerned, the most important character, and this is a continue, really, it should be, could have been 5b, but the most important character in terms of the end of days is Mashiach ben Yosef, which, by the way, is quite remarkable because Mashiach ben Yosef is only mentioned one time in the entire Talmud. Gemara in Sukkah on page 52. It's mentioned in passing. There's such a thing called Mashiach ben Yosef. And the Vilna Gaon says, he, and maybe I'll come back to this soon, but there's a whole developed understanding of the end of days. And I'll put it this way, it's not 99%, it's 999 out of 1,000. It's 99.9% as far as he's concerned, are going to be things done by Mashiach ben Yosef, and then Mashiach ben David comes at the very end for the last step. As I already said, the struggle between Yaakov and Yosef centers around two things, the bracha and the bechorah, which, by the way, are the same three-letter root, bet, rit, and kaf. Okay, and that's important, but just to file away, because we're not going to speak about that. The fact that Yosef is the only one to get the bracha, the fact that Yosef is the one to receive the bechorah, and please recognize, as far as bechorah goes, as far as bracha goes, all 12 could have received it. As far as Bechorah goes, there's at least four good candidates, because when you have four wives, the advantage is that you get to have four firstborn. But even that, there may have been a more politic way of dealing with it. Yosef receives everything, and this causes jealousy. How do we say jealousy in Hebrew? And kin'ah. And now we're getting to the cat. The Vilna Gaon points out that the cat is an animal, no offense, for those of you who like cats, are very jealous animals, and he says, therefore, what the cat represents in the story, Chad Gadya, we have the cat represents jealousy, but there's a little more information that you need. The jealousy, he says, is directed towards Yosef. There's a midrash in the Tanchuma that says that Yosef and Zion, have the exact same, how should we put it? The same history. It's both of them, there's a great deal of jealousy towards them. And the history of both are very, very similar. The Midrash doesn't say it, but it means it. Because sometimes you need to know how to read between the lines. Yosef, and again, the Vilna Gaon is a mathematician. Yosef in Gematria, those of you who are not quick at the counting, is 156. Tzion in Gematria is 156. Kin'ah in Gematria is 156. So therefore, the cat represents jealousy, represents the attitude towards Yosef. Whenever they see Yosef, there is going to be this incredible sense of jealousy. That's the way that things work. And now again, for the Vilna Gaon, he hasn't told us this yet, but we're just giving you a little bit of this hint. The attitude that the brothers had to Yosef will be the attitude that the rest of the nations of the world are going to have towards Eretz Yisrael and towards Tzion. Okay? Because here you have a microcosm and a macrocosm, but it's the exact same phenomenon taking place. So just realize that there is this other leap that needs to take place. Because they hated and were jealous, the sin'ah and kin'ah towards Yosef, what do to him? They sell him off as a slave. What is going to be the unintended, again, the zavin ava, we're going back, and now you're going to have the cat come in. And what is going to be the unintended consequence of selling your brother? is that all of you will end up becoming slaves. Which means, why do the Jewish people end up in Egypt? They end up in Egypt because they end up going down looking for food. But who's the one who arranged for there to be food there? That was Yosef, based upon his vision, collecting the food and so on. Yosef, whose dreams really do come true, and the brothers never believed him or his dreams. So you took Yosef, who was, again, not, for the Vilna Gaon and maybe even for us, he's one of the most impressive people in Tanakh. He's somebody with so much insight. He's somebody who really does see the future. He knows how to interpret the situation. And Yosef turns Egypt into an economic powerhouse. And because Yosef is in Egypt, what's going to end up happening? They're going to get very wealthy. And what's going to happen? The brothers are going to come looking for food. And what's going to happen? Again, one thing, again, Achad Gadya's story is going to take place. And what's going to happen? You sold your brother as a slave. He becomes king. And you will all end up becoming slaves. So again, that is so far what the Vilna Gaon has told us about the Chad Gadya. Continue. He then gives a second introduction and explains something that we would not have ever thought. And now he's up to the stick, the chutra. The chutra, in the Gadya, right? The stick comes, right? So, and by the way, he explains it out of order. So don't get upset with me. And he doesn't necessarily explain every single step along the line. Then comes the chutra. What is the chutra? So any one of you who've actually studied the Chumash with the Targum will know that every time in the Chumash it used a certain word, the Targum said chutra. And what word is that? Mateh. The Mateh. Which means the chutra, the staff, is Moshe's staff. What does Moshe's staff do? Miracles. Which means the chutra is the miraculous. The chutra comes in, and as far as he's concerned, he says the chutra is the miracles, the chutra is the anane hakavod, and the chutra is the Beit HaMikdash. All of this comes from the Vilna Gaon, from the chutra, but again, it's seeing something in its pure form and then understanding how it morphs into other things along the way. So it's essentially saying the miraculous, what is a miracle? It really is when God gets involved in our lives. So what is Anani HaKavod when God gets involved in our lives and protects us? What is the Beit HaMikdash when God is involved in our life? And again, we can explain much more, but I just want you to see more or less what it is the Vilna Gaon is saying. He then adds that Moshe gives all of his power to Yehoshua. And then Moshe will walk off the stage. Who is Yehoshua? Yehoshua is from which tribe? From Ephraim. And Ephraim is obviously from Yosef. And why is this going to be significant? Because, as we've already seen, Yosef is of incredible significance. When there's a battle against Amalek, who's going to lead the battle? Yehoshua. Why Yehoshua? Because he is from Yosef. Why does Yosef have the ability to defeat Amalek? So pay attention. Because Amalek comes from Esav, has a complaint. What's his complaint? You don't know what my brother did to me. I came in and I was exhausted and I said, give me some food. And he says, only on condition you give me the firstborn. And by the way, what does it say about the Bechorah? Vayivez Esav et Bechorah. He detested to be the firstborn. He didn't want the responsibility. He didn't want to be a slave. Esav wants immediate gratification. Which means that as far as Esav was concerned, this was the best deal he ever made. What did he trade? He traded a responsibility for real food right now, for a bowl of chulent. Right? And as far as he was happy, he liked chulent. I mean, that was it. That's what he got. He was very, very pleased. So Esav can now later on come back. Again, notice, as soon as the Jews leave Egypt and start the path to the land of Israel, suddenly Amalek comes. Hold it. Where's our land of Israel over here? And then they get involved. Then they, meaning they also, you have unforeseen consequences. Selling off the Bechorah is going to end up you lost the land of Israel. So now Amalek shows up. Who does Moshe send to fight? Yehoshua. Why? Because Amalek and Esav have a moral argument. The moral argument is as follows. Our brother took advantage of us, or our brother took advantage of me, my brother took advantage of me, says Esav, I was hungry, and he went and took something of great value. Yosef then turns around, and therefore he wants to kill him. What does he say right afterwards? That Esav wants to kill him. And what happens now? Amalekam wants to kill him. So Yosef turns around and says, oh, Your brother did what to you? Your brother, you traded, and your brother gave you food like you asked for, and you were greedy, and that's the terrible thing your brother did to you, and you want to kill him? And then Yosef can respond and say, well, you know what my brothers did to me? My brothers tried to kill me. My brothers sold me off as a slave. They all plotted and planned to get rid of me. And you know how I got back at them? I took care of them. For around 80 years, I gave them food, and I gave them jobs, and I gave them places to live, because that's how brothers act with one another, even after we sometimes don't get along. Which means that's the power that Yosef has to destroy Amalek. And by the way, notice, Rashi already said it. As soon as Yosef is born, Yaakov is no longer afraid. He says, now it's time to go back to the land of Israel. But Esav wants to kill him. No, once Yosef is there, Rashi says it. Once Yosef is there, he's the sitno, the opposite, right? The sitno, by the way, what does the word sitno mean? Satan. He is the sitno, he is the opposite. And keep this in mind. Yosef is the opposite from Esav. Yosef and Esav are opposites, but they're much closer connected than you ever would have imagined. So now we need maybe a little bit of Kabbalah 101. And let me just say this. In the Kabbalistic system, there are certain things that have power. Almost everything that has power other than the divine, almost everything that has power, which means even divine things which are here on earth, divine powers which are manifest, almost always has a counterfeit to it. Which means whenever there's a real Kedusha, there's going to be a counterfeit Kedusha. The only exception to this is when you finally talk about God, at that point there's one God. But there's all kinds of things in this world which are counterfeit. The way in Kabbalistic language it refers to it is as a klipa. A klipa is the skin, the peel, the outside. It looks like it, but it's not really it. You can get fooled by it. But just now you heard it. Rashi already told us this, that Esav and Yosef are opposites, and Yosef has the ability to defeat. And I'm going to say it again. That's why Yeshua ends up going down. So keep that in mind as well. The fire comes, and what does the fire do? The fire destroys the staff. The fire is the Yetzer Hara, and the Yetzer Hara destroys the Beit HaMikdash. Where did the Beit HaMikdash get into it? Because what did he already tell us? That the stick turns into the Anani HaKavod, the Anani HaKavod turn into the Beit HaMikdash. What destroys the Beit HaMikdash? The Yetzer Hara destroys the Beit HaMikdash. That's the next step. Then comes the ox to drink the water. Now, again, pay attention. The water put out the fire. As far as he's concerned, Ein Mayim Ela Torah. Right? Water is Torah. Water represents Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael who studies Torah could put out the fire. Which means when the Yetzer Hara gets the best of us, which destroys the Beit HaMikdash. When we embrace Torah, what happens? We can now build the Beit HaMikdash. But what happens? Now comes what's the Torah? You should all remember from yesterday. What's the Torah? It's the shore. What's the shore? Okay, good. What's the shore represent? So he says, shore is Edom. Shore is Esav. Hold it. What just happened? The biblical character who's normally connected with the shore, who is it? It's Yosef. What did I say 2 minutes ago? That Yosef and Esav are mirror images. Yosef and Esav are mirror images. One is what I would call the shore shebikdusha, and one is the shore bituma. So here, when the Jews built the second Beit HaMikdash, that's the water, and that's the Torah, what happens then? Then the shore comes in, and the shore drinks up the water, and the shore comes in, Edom comes in, to destroy Am Yisrael. But then somebody shows up. Who's that? The Shochet. And the Vilna Gaon says, the Shochet is Mashiach ben Yosef. And Mashiach ben Yosef is the Shochet, and he comes, and he shechs the shore. By the way, notice, in Yosef's own life, did he ever come in contact? Did he ever come in contact with the Shochet? Yeah, Potiphar. What's Potiphar called? Sar HaTabachim. Again, Targum Onkelos. What does he say? That he was? He was the chief executioner. He was the Shochet. So again, you have Yosef, who is the one who kills B'Kedusha, versus these powers, including... That's what I want you to notice. Yosef is the one, and he's the one Jew who got his hands dirty. He's the one Jew who knows how to make a living. He's the one Jew who knows how to handle himself within this non-Jewish world. He's somebody who knows exactly how to deal with the Esavs of the world, and this is part of why the Vilna Gaon is so attracted to Mashiach ben Yosef, because the Vilna Gaon believes, and again, here I'm saying something he doesn't tell us here, but he says it in other places, he believes that the messianic process is one that we need to create, that we need to roll up our sleeves, and we need to go ahead and do it ourselves, which again, any of you who were here yesterday will now appreciate that that was all really coming from what the Vilna Gaon told his students. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But unfortunately for the Shochet, what are we told afterwards? That the Malach HaMavis comes and is going to kill the Shochet. So here's this other great secret that you need to know. A lot of people, for a lot of time, thought Yosef was dead. But what turned out to be the reality? Od Yosef Chai. So the Vilna Gaon uses this concept of Od Yosef Chai, that people, by the way, the only time it mentions Mashiach ben Yosef, it says that, the Gemara says that one day there was this incredible mourning. So one opinion is, for something which I won't get into now, one says, for Mashiach ben Yosef who had been killed, so the Vilna Gaon understood that, no, they thought he was killed, but he really wasn't killed. And by the way, this is an accepted Kabbalistic tradition. The Arizal knows about it, others know about it. Even if you open up a Sfardi Siddur that has the Kavanot, it says by the words V'chise David, you have to have in mind that Mashiach ben Yosef doesn't really get killed. That Mashiach ben Yosef is somebody, because he's so physical and involved in the real world, suffers through this possibility of being very, very vulnerable. But if we pray properly or we behave properly, then maybe we can keep Mashiach ben Yosef alive. And that is a part of the whole thing. But at this point, I want to go a little bit further. The way he ends the whole thing is as I told you. The whole story of the Chad Gadya involves a backstory. The backstory is the whole thing is really about Mashiach ben Yosef. The whole thing is about Yosef the prototype who gets sold into slavery, and at the end of the day you don't even realize, but it was Yosef and therefore Mashiach ben Yosef who's the one who's going to be doing all the work in the first place, but Mashiach ben Yosef will end up being hated and jealous and maybe attempted to be killed. I'm going to skip right now, a couple of hundred years after the Vilna Gaon died, just to begin to understand what is going on. Rav Kook, very famously, gave credit to Herzl and said he thinks that Herzl may have a spark of Mashiach ben Yosef. And of course, what happened to Rav Kook when he said this? He was attacked. How could you say such a thing? A non-religious person? But this was not an isolated thought of Rav Kook. How did Rav Kook look at all the farmers? How did he look at all of the people that were building the land? He looked at all these people doing holy work. Now why? Where did this thought come from in Rav Kook's mind that these people were doing something which was positive? And it's this point that I want to pause, and I have finished the first part, which is the Vilna Gaon's commentary, but now I want to take the Vilna Gaon's commentary and read it right back into his life and understand what he did with this and how this works moving forward, and maybe then we'll understand a lot more about where we are today. I give no predictions where we'll be tomorrow, but again, this whole background is quite important. And now let's go further. At two points in the Vilna Gaon's life, he picked up and decided to go to the land of Israel. Both times it didn't work out. We don't know why. He tried to go to Israel. We know actually that he got as far as Amsterdam. There's actually a log of visitors in the community in Amsterdam that has a log of him having visited the neighborhood there. But he never ends up making it any further and making it to the land of Israel. Twice, we have the letter that he wrote to his wife saying, I'm going now, goodbye. I'm going to the land of Israel and I hope to see you again. And he saw her again, much quicker than he thought. So twice he tries to go, and it doesn't work. So there are countless interpretations and explanations why the Vilna Gaon never made it to the land of Israel. I am going to use the more Kabbalistic interpretation because it fits in with everything else we're saying today. Initially, the Vilna Gaon believed that anybody who's involved in building the land of Israel, physically building Jerusalem, has, and these are his words, has a spark in their soul of Mashiach ben Yosef. Any of you in apartments in Jerusalem? As far as he's concerned, there's a spark of Mashiach ben Yosef within you, and that's what allows you to be involved in the building of Jerusalem, the building of Tzion, and that is the role of Mashiach ben Yosef, because Yosef and Tzion aren't connected. That's what the Vilna Gaon said. He personally believed that he had this potential to spearhead this movement, to come to the land of Israel, and to start building up Jerusalem. Not in the sense, let me go and say all kinds of incantations, let us go and start building Jerusalem. The Vilna Gaon tried once and he tried twice. In the end, he gives up and he says it was not meant to be. Something happened along the way that he felt that he got a message, he needs to turn around and go back. And this is the way he explained it to one of his students. Now, what he did is, he calls in some of his closest, it's not just students, it's relatives. He calls in his cousins, two cousins of his, and he says to them, we need to start building. And they say, but isn't it dangerous? And he says, Europe is more dangerous. He says, those of you in Israel have a chance of survival. Those who stay over here behind, nothing will be left over here. This is what he tells them. He died in 1797. He tells them to go and start building, and this is where salvation would come from. You have to start going to the land of Israel. It takes them a little bit of time. By 1812, 1813, his students, cousins all gather. They sold their businesses, whatever. They start to go. By the way, the first family that comes, again, a whole group of them come. They make it through Tveri. They eventually come to Jerusalem. The leading family in Jerusalem there is the Rivlin family. The president of Israel today is descendant of that family, of the Vilna Gaon's cousins who were sent to Israel to build up. Okay, that is the Rivlin family, and a very, very large family. But he sent them all, we need to start building. He said to them, your role is the role of Mashiach ben Yosef. So when Rav Kook came and said that this was, he was just following the Vilna Gaon. There was nothing really new over there. By applying it to Herzl, it was obviously took a great deal of guts, but we're skipping a couple of steps. The Vilna Gaon himself, though, says, I can't go. And they said, why not? And he said, I've come to the realization that I cannot be actively involved in this because apparently, and he says this with sadness, he says, apparently my learning Torah is too proficient and my soul is really the soul of Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe was not allowed into the land of Israel, and I am not allowed to go into the land of Israel. And the Vilna Gaon says, I have to stay outside of the land. But just like Moshe sent Yehoshua, he says to his cousins, you will be my Yehoshua, you will go in, and you need to go and build. And if it's at that point that I want to make a division between the Vilna Gaon's followers. Because he, and I'm going to simplify this, because he really has two types of followers that then continue. One would be, before I started today, if I would have asked you, who was the most famous follower of the Vilna Gaon, you all would have said to me, Rav Chaim Volozhin. And Rav Chaim Volozhin then goes and starts to build this yeshiva in Volozhin. And the yeshiva Volozhin, I don't know how much I need to tell you about the yeshiva Volozhin, but this is the greatest yeshiva which had existed within Europe. And the Vilna Gaon's students then start to spread Torah throughout Europe. Years and years ago, I came across a document. And as I said, who knows with legends like this? But it was a document which reported what happened on the day of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's bar mitzvah. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's father was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim was a Rebbe in Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin. His grandfather-in-law was the Netziv. The Netziv was the son-in-law of Rav Itzala Mivolozhin. Rav Itzala was the son of Rav Chaim Volozhin. So, at Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's bar mitzvah, the Netziv tells over the following story. He says that I once heard from Rav Itzala, he says, I heard from my father-in-law Rav Itzala many, many years ago. The Netziv lived in old age. He said, I heard the following thing from him. He said that once Rav Chaim Volozhin went in to speak to the Vilna Gaon. And by the way, I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I've seen this from other writers as well. You would think that Rav Chaim Volozhin was a student by the Vilna Gaon. He maybe met him 10 times in his life. He collected all of his difficult questions, and he would go visit him a couple of times. And but he saw him as being his Rebbe. I mean, the Vilna Gaon is my Rebbe, whatever he says. But so realize that the Rav Chaim Volozhin himself was the Gadol Hador till he walked through the threshold to meet the Vilna Gaon. When he met the Vilna Gaon, suddenly he was himself like a young student. And he said that he once had the chutzpah to ask him the following question: how will we know that the Messianic age is getting close? So the Gra thought for a second and said, in order for this to happen, Torah needs to spread throughout the world, and then the Shekhinah can return to Eretz Israel. So he says, and what's the last place that Torah has to get to before it can go back? So the Gra said, America. This is 1770s. 1776, America's starting. He said, America is the last place that has to become a Makom Torah, and then the Shekhinah can go back. And this the Netziv told over at the Bar Mitzvah of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and one has to wonder then, when Rav Moshe Soloveitchik had to make a choice where to go when he left Europe, where do I go to? And he made this decision, I'm going to go to America. Could it have been, again, this is what he told his family. He said that he had a Mesorah from the Vilna Gaon, that America has to become a place of Torah, and therefore he ends up going to America. So I said that it's just an unbelievable story. His son, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's son, of course, is Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. And I can tell you, in 1930, he told people that, again, he finishes his doctorate, and he wants to stay in Europe like everyone else wants to stay in Europe. America is a spiritual wasteland. And Rav Soloveitchik, he writes this. He said that he cried and he prayed to God to please find him a job in Europe, that he can stay in Europe. And he couldn't get a job, so he had to go to America. And he says, point is that sometimes you think you know what you're davening for. I'll tell you a very similar story. Rav Lichtenstein's father, some of you may have known him, studied with him, Dr. Yechiel Lichtenstein, he, in 1940, the family is in France. The two children are born in France. There were only two at the time, I believe. Maybe all three were born. And they had French citizenship. The parents had Polish citizenship. And they had a rumor, they understood that if they have only Polish citizenship, they'll be in trouble in France. They need to get French citizenship, and then they'll be protected. He got on a bicycle, and he rode hundreds of kilometers on Shabbos. That's not Mechal Shabbos. It's Pikuach Nefesh. He went to another city, because he heard in this other city he can get French citizenship for him and his wife, and that will save their lives. And he gets there after being Mechal Shabbos, driving there by the bicycle. He gets there, and they say, sorry, we cannot get citizenship for you. But there was a cousin of his wife's who happened to be there and said, listen, you're not going to get citizenship, but I can get you a couple of visas to get out and get to America. And they literally got out in 1940 on the last boat out of Europe. Again, you davened for French citizenship, and a Kodesh Baruch Hu decides no. But what I want you to understand is both of these stories are taking you in the exact same place. Rav Soloveitchik prayed to stay in Europe. That's the future of Judaism. Who understood that the future of Judaism is not in Europe? Who understood like this what the Vilna, the other, I don't want to use the word prophecy, inside the Vilna Gaon said to the other part, the cousin says, go to Eretz Israel, Europe is gone. Okay, if it's not tomorrow, 100 years, 150 years, it's gone. Europe is not the future. Get out. Go. You'll be safe in Eretz Israel. Go. So meanwhile, what we have is something interesting. We have the Vilna Gaon who, on the one hand, is pushing people to come to Eretz Yisrael, and the other hand, learning Torah and building yeshivas. And this Volozhin yeshiva ends up producing, literally, the greatest Talmid Chachamim of its age. I mean, I collected a whole list, but I don't know why to bother. I mean, I think that you'll know and you'll appreciate. But it's even the people that learned in Volozhin who then opened up. I'll give you one example, one that you wouldn't even think of. Yisrael Salanter. Did he have anything to do with Volozhin? So the answer is no. He didn't learn in Volozhin. But who was his Rebbe who inspired him? Rav Zundel from Salant. Rav Zundel Salant was a Talmud Muvok of Rav Chaim Volozhin. Every other yeshiva, just about in Europe, that you can find, end up being opened by followers of Yisrael Salanter. If you want, if you... So almost all of the Rosh Yeshiva in America, all learned in Slobodka. Slobodka was incredibly, incredibly successful. Where did Slobodka come from? The Alta Slobodka was a student of Rav Yisrael Salanter. Who was a student of Zundel Salant, who was a student of Chaim Volozhin, who was a student of the Vilna Gaon. And again, I can go and point in every direction. In every, the Vilna Gaon decided, felt, had an insight, had whatever you want, that he needs to still teach Torah like Moshe Rabbeinu in Chutz Laretz, who has to stay with the other tribes. He can't go. And what we end up then having is, I'm going to say it again, these two different paths that go, and I want to hone in specifically on Rav Kook and on Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik wanted to come here in 1935, and those of you who know, he was here in 1935. He came here, he wanted to be chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, which is, part of the thought before when I first agreed to come here was maybe talking some of this, or maybe talking about Rav Kook, and I'm not going to talk as much about Rav Kook that I wanted to, maybe a little more tomorrow. But Rav Soloveitchik wanted to become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and you know why he lost the election? There was somebody who was very, very powerful in the Mizrahi who campaigned against him, who said that he's not Zionist enough. And the person was a relative, of course. His uncle? Who? Who? Nope, his uncle wasn't here yet. It had nothing to do with it at that point. It was a different. It was Meir Bar-Ilan, Meir Berlin, who was a Zionist leader. Meir Bar-Ilan said, maybe you should become a Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Israel, but become a Rav, I mean, he just felt that this was completely inappropriate. And he campaigned against him, and by the way, there were three candidates initially. The three candidates were Rav Herzog, Rav Amiel, and Rav Soloveitchik. And by the way, there may have been more. Rav Kook passed away. Rav Herzog ends up becoming the replacement for Rav Kook as the chief rabbi of Israel, or whatever you want. It's really of Palestine. Nobody wants to say it, but he was the chief rabbi of Palestine, not of Israel. And Rav Amiel ends up, again, it was much easier, one against one. Rav Amiel gets the election mainly because one of the Zionist leaders, who's Meir Bar-Ilan, who campaigns against his relative, Rav Soloveitchik. And alas, Rav Soloveitchik has to get on a boat and go back and go to Boston and end up staying, being stuck in America the rest of his life. But I want to go back to this inside of the Vilna Gaon. But still, that was much, much later. I know, but it's conflating things a little bit. His family wasn't here yet. His family was all in Europe. Nobody was here. He wasn't in Mizrahi for his own reason. Nothing to do with his family. I mean, so I'm saying his family are not involved at all yet. The Griz, his uncle, the Brisker Rav, escaped Europe. He lost his first wife and until like 11 children during the Holocaust. He wasn't here yet. There were no Soloveitchiks of note in Eretz Yisrael at that particular point, which means the things that later on, when he was offered to run in 1959, that's when he gets completely, completely frightened because of his family. But in 1935, I mean, quite the opposite. 1935, he had support, but you're right, he had a good support, other support. It was the opposite. It's like everything was opposite then, and he wasn't considered Zionist enough. I mean, Rav Soloveitchik himself doesn't become a card-carrying member of the Mizrahi until the 1950s, until after the Holocaust. 1935, again, it's a completely different world. Right. So by the Aguda Convention in I believe 1939, 1940, when Chaim Moshe Gudzinski passes away, it's the Rav who gave, again, that Hesped is known. He gave the Hesped at the Aguda Convention from Chaim Moshe Gudzinski. Such a thing that one cannot imagine having happened 20 or 25 years later. So again, full stop. But again, I want you to appreciate that it's sort of like, and again, maybe I'm over analyzing and looking at things more mystically than they should, but apparently a Kaddish Baruch Hu decided the same way that the Vilna Gaon gets this message that he needs to stay in Europe and he needs to teach Torah in Europe and Europe still needs to spread. Torah needs to spread into different places. Rav Soloveitchik needs to stay in America and America needs to become a place which is a Makom Torah. And again, I'm going to say it. If you think about how America becomes a place of Makom Torah, if you look at those graduates of Slobodka, which include Rav Hutner and include Rav Ruderman and includes Rav Kamenetsky, all of these people learned at Slobodka, learning from the student of Israel Salanter, who end up learning from the student of Rav Zundel Salant, from Rav Chaim Volozhin, and by the way, this includes Rav Aaron Cutler, and you start including even the Mir Yeshivas connected as well. If you end up looking, you realize that the Vilna Gaon's spiritual descendants, like this prophecy, as it were, goes in two directions. We need to build Eretz Israel, and we need to spread Torah throughout the world. And apparently, it wasn't just Rav Meir Bar Ilan who didn't want Rabbi Soloveitchik to be here. Apparently, it was a Kodesh Baruch Hu who didn't want him to be here. A Kodesh Baruch Hu wanted him to teach Torah in America. He wanted him to be there in order to have Torah spread. But again, what I'm going back to is this Chad Gadya type of unforeseen consequences of when certain things happen. We don't always realize what's going to happen next. If I can now take the Vilna Gaon's mystical messianism, I would say, on the one hand, there's this natural, we need to do this. On the other hand, it's messianic. And I believe that Rav Kook, and I'm going to talk about Rav Kook the father, that Rav Avraham Yitzchak, Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik took those two parts of the Gra and sort of divided it, where Rav Soloveitchik's Zionism is a very non-messianic Zionism. It's one which is very much one which is natural, and one which is a rational Zionism, one which is a moral Zionism. Again, don't think I'm going to say the opposite words than the other side, but what ends up happening with Rav Kook's Zionism is very much a messianic Zionism. While if you go back to Rav Kook, it was messianic and it was natural, because that was the importance of being this follower of Mashiach ben Yosef, which is very much, again, I'm going to say, this natural process which is taking place. And therefore, Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak, is able to come over here. And by the way, there's another parallel, which I'm just mentioning in passing, which I think is interesting. Rav Kook opened the yeshiva in Yafo. Rav Soloveitchik opened the yeshiva in Boston. Almost nothing is remembered of those two yeshivas. Rav Soloveitchik obviously is known for being in Yitzchak Elchanan and YU for the 40-something years that he was there. And this little yeshiva that he had is all but forgotten. The name of the yeshiva was Heichel Reb Chaim Halevi. There had two rebbeim in the yeshiva. One rebbe was Rav Soloveitchik. The other was his cousin, Rav Yechiel Michel Feinstein, Rav Moshe's nephew. Rav Soloveitchik's mother's maiden name was Feinstein, but that's not how they're related, because his aunt married a Feinstein, which was Rav Moshe's father. A Feinstein married a Feinstein. His mother was a Levi. Rav Moshe was not a Levi. And this other cousin, Rechiel Michel, who became afterwards, ironically, the son-in-law of the Briska Rav, of the Griz, those two were the Rosh Yeshiva. But again, something unexpected happened, and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik died at a very young age, a relatively young man. He passed away, and his son, and by the way, his son had to fight. But people didn't want him to come in. Again, he was too young, and he was too a lot of other things as well. And the Aguda came out in writing, supporting, saying that he should inherit to be the Rosh Yeshiva after his father. So as I said, things that you wouldn't, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik comes to America because he hears this by his bar mitzvah. This is what the Vilna Gaon wants him to do, and he ends up dying relatively young. And Rav Soloveitchik opened up a nice yeshiva in Boston, now has to start his commute, which will take place till the end of his life, in 1940 to the end of his life, making his commute every single week, and he opens up the small yeshiva. On the other hand, Rav Kook opens up a small yeshiva in Yafo. He has two rebbeim in the yeshiva. Am I saying things that no one has any idea about, correct? One was a man named Rav Shach, who was of no relation to the Rav Shach that you've heard of. No, not from the same family. But this other Rav Shach is from the Shach, which is how he got the name Shach. And yet another Rebbe at the yeshiva, his name was Rav Yom Tov Geffen. So I'd be correct in assuming that none of you ever heard of his name as well. So I'll tell you a little bit about Yom Tov Geffen, and then I guess we'll... because. That's Tobias Geffen, I believe, and that's a completely, as far as I know, different family. But this Yom Tov Geffen was an autodidact who had known, again, he had known all kinds of things. Apparently one of the reasons people don't know about the yeshiva. So I'll tell you more about him in a second, and we'll finish up with him. We'll see where all this ends up. But what happened was World War I broke out. Rav Kook, again, back to the same irony. Rav Kook was in Europe on the way to a Aguda convention. He was also a member of the Aguda at the time. He was on the way to an Aguda convention. He got stuck in Europe without the right papers. He literally had to escape, ends up in Switzerland. He's in Switzerland for over a year or so, and then he ends up going to London, where he becomes a rabbi in London. If you want, I have the exact address that he lived, if anybody's really interested. He becomes a rabbi in London for a couple of years, learns English. Many years later, he comes to America, he meets with the president, and there's a whole group of rabbis. He's the only one who can speak English, because he lived in London for a couple of years. Anyway, when he comes back to Israel, he never comes back to Yafo. Everything in Yafo was destroyed, and that has to do with a whole other story. But during World War I, essentially, there was no longer any Jewish presence in Yafo. All the Jews were emptied out. But one of his, the other Rebbe who was here was this Yom Tov Geffen. So Yom Tov Geffen, as I said, was an incredibly talented person. So just to put this together, there was a Chaver Knesset whose name was Shmuel Dayan. Shmuel Dayan had a son named Moshe Dayan, who had a daughter named Aviva. Aviva Dayan married Yisrael Geffen, Yom Tov Geffen's grandson. He had a son named Yonatan, who was a famous writer and performer, and Yonatan had a son named after his mother, who had apparently committed suicide. Her name was Aviva, and they named the son Aviv Geffen. But it's good because most of you don't know who Aviv Geffen is. So Aviv Geffen is a great, great grandson of Rav Yom Tov Geffen, who Rav Kook had brought in to become the Rosh Yeshiva in his little yeshiva. And I'm going to say these consequences. Rav Kook, for his part, fell in love with every single person who was building the land of Israel. Because he said every single person who was building the land of Israel has a spark of Mashiach ben Yosef. And where did he get that from? He got that right back from the Vilna Gaon. Because the Vilna Gaon says that is the job of this generation. I don't know how long a generation lasts. He says that is our job, is to build up the land of Israel. Again, in 1790-something, to say it, that Europe is not the future. We need to pick up. We need to go. On the other hand, Torah needs to be strengthened and get all over. And the last place it's going to get to is going to be America. So as I said, this was Chad Gadya, according to the Vilna Gaon, his interpretation in terms of how to understand it, and then an application about how we use it as we look forward. And I think that along the way, we saw many, many, many unforeseen consequences.